Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, in two parts, Senator Rand Paul, a Kentucky Republican, yesterday asked President Trump to revoke the security clearances of six former Obama administration intelligence officials who have been harshly critical of the president. Trump is considering the request, but why do former officials with no governmental responsibility, who are now employed by media outlets, have security clearances in the first place? Next is the second half of that conversation. Then, as the Senate continues its deliberation on passing the enormous $717 billion defense spending bill for 2019, new details continue to emerge. The bill is likely to include a number of provocative policies aimed at turning up pressure on Russia, including allocating $250 million for lethal military aid to Ukraine. And then the Israeli military said today that it had shot down a Syrian fighter jet after it entered Israeli airspace, an allegation the Syrian government denies. The announcement sparked fears of a widening conflict. And finally, the Trump administration said today that 463 immigrant parents may already have been deported without their children, adding yet another stumbling block to the reunification of families in advance of a court-ordered deadline to do so on Thursday. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to Washington and a controversy over security clearances. Senator Rand Paul, a Kentucky Republican, yesterday asked President Trump to revoke the security clearances of six former Obama administration intelligence officials who have been harshly critical of the president. Trump is considering the request. But why do former officials with no governmental responsibility, who are now employed by media outlets, have security clearances in the first place? We're joined in studio by Joe Loria. He's the editor-in-chief of Consortium News, founded by the late Robert Perry, and he's the author of the book How I Lost by Hillary Clinton. And we're also joined in studio by Ray McGovern. He's a former CIA analyst turned political activist and journalist, and he's a member of VIPS, Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. Great to have both of you.
Thanks.
Thank you, John.
Ray, let's start with you. Why do former intelligence officials who have no current governmental responsibilities have security clearances?
Well, it's actually a courtesy extended to former directors of Central Intelligence, directors of CIA. If you go back to Alan Dulles, that enabled his foot soldiers to be in full touch with him, first to talk about the assassination of John Kennedy, and later to talk about how best to cover it up. And sorry to say, that continues to this day. More recently, you have John Brennan, who is in the dock, really. Remember where you heard it first, 6 weeks from now or thereabouts. He and Comey and others at the highest level will have to answer for their shenanigans. That's a mild word to use with respect to the soft coup attempt to prevent Trump from winning the presidency, and then later to make him impotent, make him unable to carry out the policies that he wished, first and foremost, to create a decent relationship with Russia. So suffice it to say that if John Brennan wants to know what the House Intelligence Committee is getting in terms of classified information, and the House Intelligence Committee, led by Devin Nunes, is the only one carrying on a really serious investigation together with the two other House committees, and then all he has to do is say, you know, I want to know about this, and he's cleared. And so his foot soldiers, the ones that participated in these shenanigans in the first place, and the ones that are trying to cover up and prevent him from going to jail, and I say that advisedly, can tell him, brief him, and make sure that he's as prepared as he possibly can be. The problem is the House Intelligence Committee and the other committees have the documents. John Brennan is vulnerable to being prosecuted and to be put in jail. People say, well, the deep state always wins. Well, so far, so good for the deep state. I don't know about this one, because Nunes has said on camera, look, if they're guilty, they're going to go on trial. If they go on trial, it's a done deed. They'll end up in jail.
Joe Loria, John Brennan has jumped into this controversy with both feet. He's worked hard to make sure that he has remained relevant in the press. He's been outspoken in his thoughts and feelings against Donald Trump. He tweeted something that was very provocative a couple of days ago. And this is the tweet. Donald Trump's press conference performance in Helsinki rises to and exceeds the threshold of high crimes and misdemeanors. It was nothing short of treasonous. Not only were Trump's comments imbecilic, he is wholly in the pocket of Putin. Republican patriots, where are you? Why would John Brennan or any other former intelligence official be so provocative other than for personal gain? What does he get out of saying something like this?
Well, I think as Ray alluded to, they don't want the U.S. and Russia to have good relations. There are probably a number of reasons for that. One might be simply defense contracts, etc. These bad relations are what American policy is based on in terms of Russia. And Trump went to Russia, met Putin. Of course, he had to deal with an indictment of GRU agents 2 days before. And so Brennan was incensed by this. The fact that it wasn't canceled, that was the reason for the timing of those indictments. So he called him out as a traitor, which is an extraordinary allegation.
It's a death penalty charge.
Well, if you look
in
at
most cases,
that's one of the maybe the only crime that's actually spelled out in the Constitution.
That's right.
And it says clearly that it has to be an aiding and abetting an enemy in a time of war. There was a later Supreme Court case with Marshall on the court. So only a few years after the Constitution, it clearly laid out that this had to be an enemy at which we are at war, and we're not at war with Russia. So technically, there can't be treason. I suspect this is why Rand Paul made this request, openly made this request, to stop the former CIA chief from calling the current president a traitor. You know, it's funny that when the White House press secretary announced this yesterday, that Trump was considering this, there was a gasp. I didn't see it, in the press room. And someone tweeted out, whatever reporter was thinking was, oh my God, those are my sources.
Of course they are. And that actually leads to my next question. Ray, this has been going on since the 1950s, these courtesy security clearances. But since the 1950s, have any of these former CIA directors transitioned into the media like John Brennan has? John Brennan is a paid employee of NBC News. Has anybody else done this kind of thing?
You know, it depends on who your employer is. There are paid employees by the U.S. government, that there's paid employees by the Israel lobby. Now, take James Woolsey. He was nominally director of the CIA during Bill Clinton.
Yeah, for about 5 minutes.
But Clinton would never see him. As a matter of fact, when that helicopter landed on the White House lawn one time, somebody said, yeah, that's probably James Woolsey trying to get it to see Bill Clinton.
Yeah. And then he ended up endorsing Bob Dole. He was so angry.
Yeah. Well, now, Woolsey is a self-admitted, as he called it, a chairman of the Presbyterian wing of the APAC, of the Israeli lobby. Whoa. You know, he's proud of that. So he gets all these briefings and he's able to go on, well, wherever they want him, and admit and spew his views. So you have him, and then you have people like John Deutsch, who actually did lose his security clearances for playing fast and loose with his computer security regulations, and he had to be pardoned. before he was let off the hook because he was guilty, just like everybody else. So we have a situation here where deep state stuff is part of what I call the military-industrial congressional intelligence media complex, okay? Ad media, all caps, because that's what's evolved over the last 55 years that I've been in this town. And that apocryphal remark, or whether it was apocryphal or real, the correspondent or the journalist saying, oh my God, there goes my sources. Well, we know that it was John Brennan that fostered the Russiagate allegations in the beginning. We know that Hillary Clinton's PR specialist, Jennifer Palmieri, admitted that even she had it hard to believe that the Russians interfered in the election, trying to help Trump. Even she had that until we got back to Brooklyn, okay? Until we got back to Brooklyn at the end of July 2016. And then intelligence sources and correspondents in bed with intelligence sources has started telling us the real McCoy, and then Obama administration would confirm them. So it's an incestuous sort of thing. The media is the main culprit now because it's so new at this, but it the gasp that, oh, there goes our sources, well, that's all true.
Joe, why has there never been congressional pressure to close these kinds of official leaks off. You know, we talk about leaks all the time. Leaks make Washington work. That's just how the city operates. But when you've got something as sensitive as this congressional investigation, or even something as sensitive as, let's say, terrorist operations. Remember, it was John Brennan who leaked information about a potential bomber coming out of the UAE that blew the source, and then the source had to be relocated to the United States for his own protection. Why is Congress not jumping up and down about these leaks?
Congress is supposed to have oversight over these intelligence agencies, but we know that that's not very serious. And usually the agencies intimidate congressional committees. It's who the leaker is, clearly. We're about to see Julian Assange be turned over to the British authorities in London. The Foreign Secretary, Jeremy Hunt, the new Foreign Secretary, said the other day that he's welcome to step outside the embassy and he'll get a warm welcome from the British police. Why? Because he is responsible for publishing major leaks that expose corruption and even war crimes by the U.S. government and other governments and other people in high positions. Their corruption has been exposed. He needs to be stopped. When it's convenient for someone high level in the U.S. government who has access to secrets, such as now still John Brennan, ex-CIA director, he could leak these things to, as also James Comey did. He admitted he did in testimony that he leaked, which could be classified information, his meeting with Trump in the Oval Office. He leaked that to the New York Times. So they leak routinely, and the press, of course, wants whatever they can get, and unquestioningly print all of this, you know, if it comes from that source, then they, because they're acting like they're assets of intelligence agents themselves. We're talking about journalists in this town. So the leaker is what's important, not what's leaked.
There was an interesting issue that came up, a couple of years ago now, with Ken Delanian, formerly of the LA Times, now with NBC News. Ken is said to be a highly respected journalist here in Washington. I would disagree with that. But Ken Delanian was caught, thanks to a Freedom of Information Act request by BuzzFeed's Jason Leopold, clearing his articles with the CIA before giving them to his own editor. And he wanted the CIA's perspective in his articles before even his editor knew what was in them. I think that is utterly unacceptable. But it goes to this relationship between the CIA and the major media outlets. And to me, that's the propagandization of the American people, which is supposed to be illegal. At least it was until a year and a half
during Operation Mockingbird, of course, the journalists were paid by the CIA. Yeah, however, there's a new book. I'm sorry, I can't remember the title right now, but the author argues that today they don't even need to be paid. They're willingly doing it for free because they want to be close to power and live vicariously through this power instead of using the power of the press to bring those people down.
And make a lot of money.
Yeah, and make a lot of money. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back and continue this very interesting conversation.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. Senator Rand Paul, a Kentucky Republican, yesterday asked President Trump to revoke the security clearances of six former Obama administration intelligence officials who have been harshly critical of the president. Trump is considering the request, but why do former officials with no governmental responsibility, who are now employed by media outlets and private corporations, have security clearances in the first place? We're joined in studio by Joe Loria. He is the editor-in-chief of Consortium News, founded by the late Robert Perry, and he's the author of the book How I Lost by Hillary Clinton. And we're also joined in studio by Ray McGovern. Ray is a former CIA analyst turned political activist and journalist and a member of VIPS, which stands for Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. And we're also joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst Walter Smolarek. Welcome.
Ray, let's turn to you. Talk about the motivation of some of these former intelligence officials. It seems to me like in the past, they were perfectly content to go from the CIA or other intelligence organizations to corporate boards where they got rich and they kept their mouths shut and nobody paid any attention to them. But it's different now. And we see so many of them, Brennan, Clapper, Hayden, Rice, others trying hard to get on TV and to remain on TV. What do you make of that?
Well, filthy lucre of course, is always a motivation here. And people like Clapper and Comey and Brennan are getting even richer than they already are. I don't know why one can't live on a on the retirement, the very generous retirement offered a CIA director. But that be that as may, they've become friends of Rachel Maddow, of course. There must be a club that you're entitled to join. And there are other motivations. Now, James Clapper, bear in mind that he was in charge of the intelligence community, and he not only lied under oath to the Senate Intelligence Committee on what NSA was doing, but he also famously said, you know, let me tell you about the history of the Russians. And this is a quote. The Russians, they are almost genetically driven to be deceitful, to be, you know, just really, end quote, to be just really bad guys. Okay, now, I'm willing to believe, I know people who have dealt with Clapper, most of my former NSA colleagues have, I'm willing to believe that he really believes that. You know, he probably studied under the Air Force generals like Curtis LeMay. So that may be part of the motivation. If you could call it ideology, okay. But the other motivation is simply this, and people have to keep remembering this. Hillary Clinton was going to win. She was a shoo-in. Now, just to make sure there'd be no doubt about her winning, Brennan, Comey, Peter Strzok, and the others had this little operation where they played fast and loose with the law, and just to make sure that she would win and then Trump would not win. That's very clear from the documents that are now in the possession of those three House committees. So what does that mean? Whoa, that means that Brennan has a really interesting and different incentive here, and that is to make sure that he knows everything that's been given to those committees and that he can artfully as he can under the circumstances, parry these blows and stay out of jail. Pure and simple. That's Brennan's motivation.
Joe, we haven't talked about James Comey yet. James Comey is one of the officials that could potentially have their security clearances revoked. Do you think James Comey is running for president? Maybe that's his personal motivation for being in the public spot. I mean, he wrote a book, right, which is something that people who are going to run for president do. He's been tweeting like very specific things about U.S. So, I mean, first there was this tweet from July 17th, which reads in part, all who believe in the country's values must vote for Democrats this fall. Policy differences don't matter right now. History's eyes are on us. And he also said this on July 22nd, 2 days ago, Democrats, please, please don't lose your minds and rush to the socialist left. This president and his Republican Party are counting on you to do exactly that. America's great middle wants sensible, balanced, ethical leadership. So, I mean, at least he's giving them bad advice, but that's like pretty specific advice. He's like really wading into the weeds of U.S. domestic politics. So, yeah, what do you think? Does James Comey want to run for office?
Well, clearly the establishment Democrats need a candidate to stop this insurgency that's growing on the left, which simply wants the American people and supposed Democrats to have policies that benefit their lives. And as John pointed out, they don't give a damn about Russia. That poll showed was even insignificant. It didn't even make 1%.
Less than 1%.
Less than 1%. But yet that's the issue that the Democrats have been using. And they're probably going to do poorly in November because they continue to use Russiagate as the issue. Blind to the fact American people don't give a damn about that. They care about health care. They care about their jobs. They care about keeping their homes. In other words, staying or getting into the middle class. And for him to say that, to say don't go with the socialists, tells you that he's trying to position himself possibly as that establishment Democratic candidate. But I also think he's just speaking from his elitist class interests, which he's part of, that Democratic elite. Republican elite previously, if he was a Republican. And so he's talking to the Democrats not to go with what is growing, this progressive wing of the party. And he's frightened of that. I think they all are. So that's Comey's deal right there. And let him run. I think Hillary Clinton's going to run myself. I think she's not out of this.
My God. Let me interject here, if I may. Comey has a personal incentive here as well. Why did he not seize the DNC computers to find out what this act of war was all about? Well, he's very vulnerable on that score. An FBI director does that kind of thing for the forensics.
And in fact, people have asked that question 1,000 times, and he's never answered it.
Well, you know, the time I remember was when this thug that runs the Senate Intelligence Committee, Richard Burr of North Carolina. He had the whole thing orchestrated. He said, "Now, Mr. Comey, this is under oath, Mr. Comey, you didn't seize or inspect the DNC computers, did you? Is that normal?" And Comey said, "Well, no, actually, best practices would dictate that I would have seen. But we had this crackerjack, this first-rate cyber. So that's why. Okay, fine. Next question." And he preempted all the other questions. Okay. Now, what I'm saying here is that Comey is running just as scared as John Brennan. Comey leaked. Now, when you leak a conversation with a president, that ipso facto is classified. I don't care where you are or how high ranking you are, that's classified. He had that leaked to the New York Times. Why? Well, he said, because I wanted a special prosecutor named. And thank you, Jesus. The next day, his best friend forever, Bob Mueller, is named the special prosecutor. And at this precise week, Peter Strzok, who works for James Comey, all right, at that time, didn't tell, apparently, James Comey that there's no there, okay? So he told Lisa Strzok, "I'm not going to get involved in this. There's no there, meaning there's no evidence to support Russiagate. But we're asked to believe that Peter Strzok forgot to tell his boss, James Comey, give me a break." So we have a prosecutor now named for the explicit purpose to help James Comey defend himself. Again, please realize Hillary was bound to win, and that's why these, quote, gentlemen, end quote, felt entitled to violate the law willy-nilly, and why they're running scared now, why they're writing books or why they're going on TV, because they're afraid that honest people like Devin Nunes, the House Intelligence Committee chairman, have the goods on them, and they do. The only question left is, will the deep state prevail this time, as they almost always do? Or will Congress, will the House stand on its congressional prerogatives and put these guys in jail?
And what do you think? What do you think is going to happen? Does Congress have the guts to actually take a stand here?
I've been amazed at Nunes, and I've been amazed at his two other chairs of the Democratic. You know, when you have the documents matter, okay? You have the documents? Well, that should mean something. And that's why in other circumstances, Comey and Brennan will be yawning and saying, they'll never come get us. But when you have documents, you've got the goods on these guys. And if this plays out over the next several months, it's likely that not only will these people face some sort of justice, but it's also likely that the incredibly stupid Democrats will take it on the chin. The American people are already seeing through their tactics, and you know they're supposed to win big in November. My God, if enough people see what the Democrats have been up to instead of defending what they should be doing, the rights of the American people, they're not going to win big in November. They might even not even win at all. So it's an incredibly stupid performance on everybody's part, but justice may be served in these circumstances.
Joe Lurie, you know, it's Republicans, too. Senator Bob Corker, he's a Republican from Tennessee, of course, an opponent of Donald Trump. Well, at least to some extent, an opponent of Donald Trump. He went on MSNBC, said, "I can't believe that somebody at the White House thought up something like this," referring to the possible revocation of security clearances. I mean, when you're going to start taking retribution against people who are your political enemies in this manner, that's the kind of thing that happens in Venezuela. So you just don't do that. I can't believe they even allowed it to be aired, to be honest. So, okay, I mean, every single day, this is not to take sides between like Donald Trump and the media. I mean, that's a different discussion. But, you know, it's just a fact that the pretty much the entirety of the mainstream corporate media is, you know, at war with the administration. And so, you know, this is like a fight. I mean, it's not like some like Donald Trump is Adolf Hitler cracking down on press freedom.
Right. It's more with the intelligence services as well. Well, I mean, it is on the face of it. It doesn't look good that he would go after someone because they've criticized him. But it's been more than criticizing. As John pointed out at the beginning of the show, Brennan has accused him of treason in public in a tweet. So you have to ask the question, why do these guys have these clearances to begin with? That's the first thing that came to my mind, and I'm sure a lot of other people's minds. And the answer I got was so they could work, they can get into the revolving door, leave their jobs, and work for the companies that they were able to sign up as contractors with the idea, wink, wink, that when they retire, they'll go to work for them. And you often need clearances to work as a contractor, obviously, with these with the intelligence agencies. That's the easy answer. The other one is whether what Ray's on about here now is that they can, Brennan and Comey and Clapper can get stuff from Democrats on the both intelligence committees who are in league with them to get Trump, so that they could know what they're talking about and go and leak it to other reporters. That's how it can get out of the committee to damage Trump. So that's what it's about, and Trump is trying to preserve himself. You know, we're not defending Trump here, at least Ray and I are. I don't think anybody else is. You know, we could disagree with him on 90% of his program on everything, basically, from taxes to health care to Iran and Palestine and climate and torture. But on Russia, he's got the right idea, in North Korea. And that seems to be the thing that really upsets. You saw the reception he got when he came back from Korea, hit the summit in Singapore. So it's extraordinary. The only good things he wants to do is what he's being attacked for.
Yep. We're going to have to leave it there. We were joined here in the studio by Joe Loria. He is the editor-in-chief of Consortium News, founded by the late Robert Perry. And Joe's also the author of the book How I Lost by Hillary Clinton. And we were also joined in the studio by Ray McGovern, a former CIA analyst turned political activist and journalist, and one of the founding members of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The Israeli military said today that it had shot down a Syrian fighter jet after it entered Israeli airspace, an allegation the Syrian government denies. The announcement sparked fears of a widening conflict in the region. We're joined from the UK by Ambassador Peter Ford. He's the former British ambassador to Syria. Ambassador Ford, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Ambassador, the Israelis are saying that this fighter jet, a Russian jet, either strayed over the Golan Heights or probed over the Golan Heights, that the IDF shot it down, and they do not know the fate of the two Syrian pilots. Do you have any sense of what the truth here is in this story?
The Israelis have a track record of lying about these things, not to put too fine an edge on it. Only yesterday, literally yesterday, they admitted that they had lied about an earlier incident involving Syrian missiles. They launched some of their super-duper newfangled David Sling missiles to intercept these Syrian missiles, which at first they said were straying over into Israeli territory, but then they've just admitted that was not true. They tried to bring them down over Syrian territory, and here's the thing, failed. Not only failed with this wonderful new weapon, David's sling, but the sling has apparently fallen into Russian and Syrian hands and is right now being de-engineered, and it will no longer be much use. So, you know, this game is going on an almost daily basis. It's a sort of game of arm wrestling. Basically, what's going on, however, is that the Israelis are squealing with pain at the presence near their border on the Golan Heights of groups of pro-Iranian militias. Now, on the Syrian side, they probably deny this, but this is probably also the truth. And this is what is giving the Israelis so much pain. And what this is what Lavrov was trying to negotiate over with the Israelis a couple of days ago. This is it's the situation on the ground with the presence of these militias, which is the real issue here.
Ambassador Peter Ford is our guest. Ambassador Ford, when I heard the initial report of this, it said Israel struck a Syrian plane that was in its air territory over the Golan Heights. And I thought, Golan Heights, that's always been Syria. And then, of course, seized by the Israelis in the 1967 war and kept by Israel in violation of international law. Just, again, for our audience, a little bit about the Golan Heights, if you would.
Yes, indeed. Years ago, the Israeli Knesset purported to annex the Golan Heights. But this has never been recognized by any country in the world, not even so far anyway, by the United States, although there are moves afoot right now in the U.S. Congress to oblige the executive to recognize the Golan Heights as Israeli territory. So when the media talk loosely about the Golan Heights, this is Syrian territory in international law. And it's divided into three zones, basically, with different degrees of demilitarization within those zones. But they are all Syrian occupied territory. And Israel has absolutely no rights to the airspace above the Golan Heights.
Resolution 242 was one of numerous UN resolutions that said just that the occupation by the Israelis seized Arab territory from the 1967 sort of blitzkrieg attack. It says just that these territories must be returned, that it's a violation of international law. Again, international law, maybe just so many words on a page, but nonetheless, an important frame of reference, no?
Absolutely. And there was a companion resolution, 338, basically making it even more clear that 242 applied to the Golan. And interestingly, Putin mentioned 338 specifically in his famous press conference the other day in Helsinki. This was the first time in decades that anybody on the international stage had issued a kind of reminder that 338 is still operative and that under international law, all of the Golan is Syrian.
And in 1993, again, just a little history for our audience, the Palestine Liberation Organization, the PLO, agreed that Resolution 242 and 338 would be the basis for the negotiations with Israel at Oslo and going forward. It seems like a dead letter, but of course it's not a dead letter because international law doesn't simply become nothing simply because criminal elements, in this case the Israeli government with the backing and financing of the U.S. government, simply choose to ignore international law. That doesn't mean the law goes away, even though it has a de facto impact on how the law is implemented. It seems to me, Ambassador Ford, that there's a problem with the American media where this discussion, the discussion we're having right now, literally does not come up at all in any of the media. You can say, well, it's the free press. We have, look at how many press outlets.
Never mentioned.
Listen to CNBC, MSNBC, CNN, Fox News, right, left, whatever those terms even mean anymore. I don't think they mean anything. None of them mention it. I mean, it's quite astonishing. It shows something about the American media. Go ahead.
Absolutely. But I suspect we're going to hear a lot more about 338 in the coming weeks and days, because there's been a significant change over the Golan in recent months and years. Prior to the beginning of the Syrian conflict, in 2011, the Golan had been quiet for decades. The Syrian government was criticized by its own people for doing nothing to recover the stolen territory. And I had discussions when I was ambassador there with Syrian officials. Why aren't you making more fuss over the Golan? I asked. They said, are you crazy? The Israelis are going to bomb us if we lift a finger. Well, here's the thing. The Israelis have been bombing Syria. There, in recent years, there have been over 100 Syrian air raids on Syria in the last 3 years. Syrians are becoming inured to being bombed by Israel. They're no longer quite so afraid of it. It is no longer unthinkable that they could risk a conflict with Israel to recover the Golan Heights. And at the end of the war for the liberation of the rest of Syrian territory from jihadis and foreign forces, it will not be at all surprising if Syrian attention turns to recovery of the Golan. And here's another thing, the presence of Iranian forces. This didn't happen before 2011 because the Syrian government didn't allow it to happen. Neither Hezbollah nor pro-Iranian militias were allowed anywhere near the Golan. But Israel has forfeited this privilege by interfering in the Syrian conflict, by bombing Syria. So all bets are off. Israel has itself created a situation where previously the Golan was quiet, but now it's coming back onto the international agenda, and questions of international law, as well as who's the strongest, are beginning to emerge.
It's really, really something when you think about it. When you frame it as Ambassador Ford has, this might be called the law of unintended consequences, which I don't even know is a law, but let's just pretend it's a law. But there are so many unintended consequences by virtue of actions taken with arrogance, with hubris, the arrogance of power. Here you had the Golan Heights quiet. U.S. government, with the support of Israel, certainly, and other players in the region, wanted to bring down the Assad government. 7 years later, the Assad government exists. Now you have Hezbollah and Iranian militias right there in the Golan Heights, and a feeling, perhaps a sense of empowerment on the part of the Syrian government or its allies, that Israel can be challenged right there. This is the law. A new thing
you've
just made up.
Yeah, you've coined it.
Of unintended consequences. 1 minute left, Ambassador Ford.
Yeah, you also say what goes around comes around. This is what Israel is discovering now, that being the bully sometimes ends up with you being punched on the nose. Israel will now have to pay a high price to secure the removal of those pro-Iranian militias. They are not going to be budged except at a very high price.
John, I think we're out of time. That was Ambassador Peter Ford.
Yes, Ambassador Peter Ford joined us from the UK. He's the former UK ambassador to Syria. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
As the Senate continues its deliberations on passing the enormous $717 billion defense spending bill for 2019, new details continue to emerge. The bill is likely to include a number of provocative policies aimed at turning up pressure on Russia, including allocating $250 million for lethal military aid to Ukraine. We're joined from Moscow by Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. Mark, good to have you back.
Thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on Loud and Clear.
Thank you very much for that. Mark, tell us a little bit about this bill. You know, it was very newsworthy when it was first proposed, and then it sort of dropped out of the headlines. Now, here we are with a little bit more detail, and that detail tells us that the pressure really is being stepped up on Russia.
Yeah, I mean, this defense spending bill, it's in the Senate, it's called the John S. McCain National Defense Authorization Act. A tribute to the neocon himself.
It should be renamed the John, I've never met a war I didn't like, McCain authorization bill.
Yeah, I think that's the subtext. It's really actually nothing remarkable. It marks a 9.3% increase in military spending over 2 years, and it allocates funding towards several things that have been in the works for years, started pushing at the end of the Obama administration on, such as low-yield, more usable mini-nukes intended for the tactical battlefield. It includes funds, more military funds for Ukraine, bringing that total now to almost $1 billion total that has been delivered to the Putsch regime in Ukraine for killing East Ukrainians. And it also includes some other more unusual non-monetary provisions, such as continuing the ban from the U.S. military having any actual military to military cooperation with the Russian military. So it's not remarkable at all, because it was passed with complete bipartisan support. There were only 10 votes against it in the Senate, and it had a similar support in the House. There were some attempts to put amendments in to kill the low yield nukes and to stop U.S. from refueling Saudi bombers as they blasted Yemen, the poorest country in the world, to pieces. These amendments were cleared out of the way, so they're not interfering with the U.S. military operations around the world. So it's really not remarkable. It marks a trend and an increase in military spending that has been occurring for about the last 5 years now. And, it removed the most recent spending caps, of course. And we're really approaching the $1 trillion military spending mark, which is very interesting because that's also the amount that our deficit is very close to.
That's Mark Sloboda. Mark is an international and security affairs analyst. We're talking to him from Moscow about the escalation by the U.S. government and the allocation of money for an escalating conflict in Ukraine and signaling the escalation of the conflict. John, yesterday we were talking about the New York Times receiving a FOIA request from the Trump administration about the FISA application for Carter Page.
That's right.
And the thing that really interested me, as I said yesterday on air, was that on page 22 or 23 of the FISA application, it stipulated that candidate number one, which was Donald Trump, sought to change the platform of political party number one, that would be the Republican Party, regarding the sending of advanced weapons to East Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
And that by virtue of having this position that defied the Republican Party consensus and the Democratic Party, it wasn't a consensus because Obama hadn't gone along with it, by defying the Republican Party consensus at least, that President Trump and his volunteers were suspect, and thus that was one of the motivations for the warrant. So here we have a situation, Mark Sloboda, where it's all coming to pass now. It is, under Trump, the official policy of the U.S. government, or it seems to be.
Yeah, I mean, it's nothing new. The U.S. has already been shipping lethal arms, anti-tank missiles to Ukraine of the U.S.'s most advanced sort. The government in Ukraine has long been getting older Soviet-era weapons from NATO partners in Eastern and Central Europe. So, yeah, that provision, which was at one time sneaked into the GOP platform by Trump, has gone the way of the wind. And the Trump administration obviously used it as an opportunism to buy off some of its domestic partisan critics, either within the GOP, the neocons, or in the Democratic Party. And that's just another forgotten Trump promise, as it were.
So what's the end game now? Is this going to be a permanent fundamental shift in U.S. relations with Ukraine and Russia, or is this something different? Is it episodic?
Yeah, I think this is just increased heightened tensions. I mean, this is nothing new. It's just a continuance of a U.S. policy. It furthers along with what happened in the U.S. Nuclear Posture Review and strategic documents, that the U.S. has now shifted fully from a war on terror footing to great power competitors, which it sees as Russia and China. And for some comparison here, just the one-year increase in defense spending, $82 billion increase for 1 year, is larger, just that increase is larger, considerably larger, than the entire Russian defense budget of $61 billion. The U.S. is now spending, not even counting overseas contingency operations, nearly 12 times what Russia does. The U.S. is spending more on defense than the next 11 countries combined, essentially all of which, other than Russia and China, are actually U.S. allies, who are also spending large sums of money, such as Saudi Arabia, United Kingdom, France, and so on. The Western bloc of nations is so far ahead of other countries in military spending, it's really ridiculous. And this is all about full-spectrum dominant. It is about a global military hegemony where the U.S. is concerned that they can dominate China in the South China Sea, Russia in the Black Sea, massing troops on Russia's borders, ringing around and going so far as to have military and drone bases in nearly every country in sub-Saharan Africa. And we've even got a little bit of extra money for new military bases in Argentina and South America and so on. This is what it's about. The moniker defense authorization, it has long since happened to have anything real to do with defense. It is, an offensive authorization act.
So, Mark, with these enormous increases in the budget and enormous budgets overall, What does this do over the long term to U.S. relations with Russia? It seems to me that if the White House, whether it's this one or any other White House, is serious about improving relations with the Russians, and this president claims that he is serious, that the military policy toward Ukraine would be the wrench that just wrecks that policy. So how can we have this two-track policy where we're supporting the Ukrainian government and seeking better relations with the Russian government at the same time? How can that possibly work?
Yeah, well, I think this is part of if you're familiar with the art of the deal, this is a part of Trump's rather clumsy, heavy-handed, proven business negotiation style. He comes in screaming, wielding a big stick, and basically he wants to beat Russia into submission on one hand with military spending and all of the things that he has done around the world, for instance, threatening to sanction Germany if they complete a pipeline with Russia, a planned gas pipeline that Germany needs for its own energy security, to increase military spending to Ukraine, its continued military occupation of East Syria, and so on. All of these things, it is about beating Russia into submission while extending a smiling rhetorical hand on the other side, saying if you'll just bow under and accept our lead in global affairs, then this can all be redirected towards someone else like China. And I think that is a big part of Trump's grand strategy, as that he seems to have picked up on from Henry Kissinger, who has been pushing for this. Henry Kissinger famously told Nixon back in 72 that if in 20 years, your successor, if he's wise, will lean the other way and back Russia against China, because Kissinger and Nixon, of course, were very instrumental in the Sino-Soviet split in the 1960s, which probably, in end result, won the Cold War for them. So now they, a grand strategic balance the other way. And I think that is the way Trump is looking. I also don't think the Russian government is that stupid. They realize that Trump will be out of office in probably just a few years if he lasts that long. And that he certainly can't fulfill his promises within his own administration, much less Congress or the next presidential term and so on. But I think that probably explains Trump's strategy and motivation with this seemingly contradictory policy towards Russia.
We're going to end it there. That was the voice of Mark Sloboda. Mark joined us from Moscow. He's an international affairs and security analyst. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. The Trump administration said today that 463 immigrant parents may already have been deported without their children, adding yet another stumbling block to the reunification of families in advance of a court-ordered deadline to do so on Thursday. We're joined from Seattle by Jorge Barran. He is the executive director of the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project, and Sputnik News analyst Walter Smolarek. Jorge and Walter, welcome back.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Jorge, I tried to scan all the major media today to look at this situation, and there's no good news here. It's as though the Department of Homeland Security, ICE, Border Patrol, nobody knows what's going on. They're deporting people wantonly. They're not connecting them with their children. How do we get past this and reunify these families?
Well, I think it's important to have the continued attention. I appreciate your covering this, because I think one of the issues is that I'm concerned about this particular issue sort of fading a little bit from the headlines, as you mentioned, because there's a sense, some people say that, there's been this court decision, the president issued this executive order that purported to end family separation, but the reality on the ground is that Many, many families, thousands of families still remain separated. And while the court has issued this deadline of this Thursday, I have very little confidence that the government is going to meet that deadline. So I think continued attention by the entire community, which did lead to some, you know, changes in policy by the administration, is what we continue to need.
And what we have, too, is a federal district court judge ordering the children to be reunified with their parents. The government cannot meet this deadline. So there is already precedent-setting court case. Can you explain what that court case is, what it does, and how it might help families in this situation?
Yeah, well, I think that it's one of those situations that it's a little bit complicated because there's a couple of different court decisions that are relevant here, but there's an older case that's called the Flores case that came out of the mid-1990s that dealt with children who were in the custody of immigration officials. And that case was essentially settled. There was a settlement where the advocates at the time in the mid-1990s settled with the government, and the government, the U.S. government, agreed to certain conditions in terms of the treatment of children when they were in custody. And so that case has intersected with the newer family separation policy because, of course, you know, the children that were taken away from their parents, the vast majority of them ended up in the custody of the government, the Office of Refugee Resettlement. And the government has been trying to sort of play off the courts by saying, well, what the San Diego court ordered us to do requires us to go into this family separation issue and into trying to detain the families together, because since we can't separate them, we got to detain them together, which conflicts with what the Flores case says, because the Flores case has said that the children should not be in a restrictive setting for an extended period of time, and the court has interpreted that to mean no more than 20 days. The government is trying to sort of use one case, one policy as a way to undermine some of the other agreements that it had made. We think that that's wrong. We don't think the children should be detained in any kind of setting like this. And so I think the fight is going to continue. And again, I think we need the political pressure to put the federal government in notice that what they're doing is just inhumane and needs to be stopped.
Yeah, I mean, I think this executive order that Donald Trump issued on June 20th, it's important to look at the actual text of that, because I think he won a major public relations victory with it, or at least, you know, he succeeded in doing damage control with this fake, phony concession. So, I mean, this is the sentence here that actually talks about family reunification, because most of the executive order is actually about how great their zero tolerance policy is. It's just sort of reiterating that they have this extreme hardline position. But so this is the part about family reunification. It is also the policy of this administration to maintain family unity, including by detaining alien families together where appropriate and consistent with law and available resources. I mean, where appropriate and consistent with law and available, that could mean anything, right? And like you pointed out, you know, the best case scenario that this executive order lays out is that alien families, quote unquote, you know, immigrant families, are detained together, held in cages together, as opposed to separately, which is, you know, I guess better, but I mean, certainly not a just solution.
Yeah, no, I mean, and we've talked to a lot of the clients that we dealt with, parents who are separated here, and they were, you know, while they were very anxious, obviously, to be with their children, they were also concerned about the prospect of being detained separately, and I mean, in a setting far away from other people, even if they were with their children. So we don't think that that's the solution. So we're concerned that that's the way the administration is heading, but we're also concerned about the fact that, you know, even still with that, we still don't see the pace to make sure that families are actually reunited by the court's deadline.
Jorge, in the Northwest, there is the Northwest Detention Center has been, I believe it's in Tacoma, Washington, right?
Correct.
I that's been the focus of a lot of activism and organizing. That's near where you're at. Is there an occupation of that facility now? I mean, tell us a little bit about the grassroots activism that's been going on along this issue, because while it's crucially important to understand the contours of the struggle in the courts, it's also important, of course, to see what's going on at the grassroots driving this issue forward.
Yeah, no, there's been tremendous work done here. I mean, from, you know, the people who are detained themselves and also by people who are formerly detained and other undocumented individuals who have led an effort that's led by an organization called the Northwest Detention Center Resistance that have really made this detention center particularly prominent in getting attention to the conditions and to particularly, you know, this terrible practice of private immigration detention centers that, you know, lead to all kinds of abuses. There's lawsuits about the, you know, way that people are paid $1 a day for labor. You know, there's been issues with medical treatment, the facility, all kinds of issues. And I think that, the grassroots efforts have been critical in making those issues come to light. And, you know, we certainly hope that this will continue to be paying attention because I think one of the things that I'm concerned in some ways is that the family separation issue has been focused more recently, but the reality is that family separation have been happening at places like the Northwest Detention Center when parents get detained by ICE in local communities. We see that issue of family separation and even people who don't have, you know, family members, we still believe that, you know, they should be treated with dignity and respect. And the current immigration system is very far from that.
Jorge, in just the last couple of minutes that we have, tell us something too. You know, there's focus this week on reunification of these families, but what about people still being seized all around the country? We've heard, well, just yesterday we heard about a young man who had served two tours in Iraq, was a decorated war hero. He came back home, happened to get a DUI and was immediately arrested and deported to Mexico. He hadn't even been in Mexico since he was a child. So has this slowed down at all since the focus changed to families and reunification, or is ICE still rounding people up and deporting them as quickly as possible?
No, that's a great point. And I think the reality is that is happening just as much as it was before. I mean, the family separation issue has come on top of all of that we were seeing even before this latest egregious practice. And so we are seeing those kind of roundups. Even here locally, you know, a couple of weeks ago, we had a big roundup in Eastern Washington. We've seen it in places like Ohio and Tennessee, where there's been large-scale workplace immigration raids, where people with long ties to the community were impacted. And so I think we can't lose sight. And one of the things that I want to make sure is that a lot of the people who have particularly got engaged on immigration and have kind of come to, you know, wanted to learn more about how immigration enforcement is happening because of this egregious policy of family separation at the border, we hope they will continue to be engaged. And this opens the door to a conversation about how agencies like ICE and CBP, Customs and Border Protection, are operating throughout the country and not just, you know, focus on the family issue, but on the broader issue of immigration enforcement.
Can any of these immigrant families who have been wronged so devastatingly pursue damages against the U.S. government? I mean, can these families sue ICE or sue DHS or, you know, any of the agencies that may be responsible for this? About 1 minute left.
Well, I think we're going to, you know, everybody's going to be looking at those issues. I mean, I think the problem for us is that, you know, in the short term, of course, our focus was on reunifying, but I think there's going to be a lot of us who will be looking at the toll that it costs on families and trying to understand that and figure out what the options are. Unfortunately, our laws are so restrictive in trying to get that kind of accountability from law enforcement agencies, including ICE, but I think a lot of us will be looking at trying to figure out if that's a possibility, because certainly morally it should be done.
Okay, that was the voice of Jorge Barone. He joined us from Seattle. Jorge is the executive director of the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.